The two officers were essentially alone with open space around them, a very unusual state of affairs. "You reading this the same way I am?" John asked. That he said it in English surprised Chavez. "He's really working them up, isn't he?" A thoughtful pause. "You're right, Mr. C. It is getting a little tense."
Godot's voice carried clearly over the speaker system. The pitch was high now, almost shrill, and the crowd answered back in the way that crowds do.
"Ever seen anything like this before?"
It wasn't like the job they'd done in Romania.
A curt nod.
"Tehran, 1979.
I was in fifth grade.
I was scared shitless," Clark said, remembering.
Goto's hands were flying around now. Clark re-aimed the camera, and through the lens the man seemed transformed. He wasn't the same person who'd begun the speech. Only 30 minutes before he'd been tentative, not now. If this had begun as an experiment, then it was a successful one. The final flourishes seemed stylized, but that was to be expected. His hands went up together like a football official announcing a touchdown, but the fists, Clark saw, were clenched tight. 20 yards away, a cop turned and looked at the two gaijin. There was concern on his face.
"Let's look at some coats for a while."
"I'm a 36 regular," Chavez replied lightly as he stowed his camera gear. It turned out to be a nice shop, and it did have coats in Ding's size. It gave them a good excuse to browse. The clerk was attentive and polite, and at John's insistence, Chavez ended up purchasing a business suit that fit so well it might have been made for him, dark gray and ordinary, overpriced and identical to what so many salarymen wore. They emerged to see the small park empty. A work crew was dismantling the stage. The TV crews were packing up their lights. All was normal except for a small knot of police officers who surrounded three people sitting on a curb. They were an American TV news crew, one of whom held a handkerchief to his face. Clark decided not to approach. He noted instead that the streets were not terribly littered. Then he saw why. A cleanup crew was at work. Everything had been exquisitely planned. The demonstration had been about as spontaneous as the Super Bowl, but the game had gone even better than planned.
"Tell me what you think," Clark ordered as they walked along streets that were turning back to normal.
"You know this stuff better than I do."
"Look, Masters candidate, when I ask a fucking question, I expect a fucking answer."
Chavez almost stopped at the rebuke, not from insult, but from surprise. He'd never seen his partner rattled before. As a result, his reply was measured and reasoned.
"I think we just saw something important. I think he was playing with them. Last year, for one of my courses, we saw a Nazi film, a classic study in how demagogues do their thing. A woman directed it, and it reminded me. Triumph of the Will, Leni Riefenstahl," Clark said.
"Yeah, it's a classic, all right.
By the way, you need a haircut."
"Huh?"
The training was really paying off, Major Sato knew without looking. On command, all four of the F-15 Eagles tripped their brakes and surged forward along the runway at Mizawa. They'd flown more than 300 hours in the past 12 months, a third of that in the past two alone, and now the pilots could risk a formation takeoff that would do an aerial demonstration team proud. Except his flight of four was not the local version of the Blue Angels. They were members of the 3rd Air Wing. Sato had to concentrate, of course, to watch the airspeed indicator in his heads-up display before rotating the aircraft off the concrete. Gear came up on his command, and he knew without looking that his wingman was no more than 4 meters off his tip. It was dangerous to do it this way, but it was also good for morale. It thrilled the ground crew as much as it impressed the curious driving by on the highway. 1,000 feet off the ground, wheels and flaps up, accelerating through 400 knots, he allowed himself a turn of the head both ways. Sure enough. It was a clear day, the cold air devoid of humidity, still lit by the late afternoon sun. Sato could see the southernmost Kuriles to his north, once part of his country, stolen by the Russians at the end of the Second World War, and ruggedly mountainous, like Hokkaido, the northernmost of the home islands. "One thing at a time," the major told himself. "Come right," he ordered over the radio circuit, bringing the flight to a new course of 055. They were still climbing gradually to save fuel for the exercise. It was hard to believe that this aircraft design was almost 30 years old, but that was just the shape and the concept. Since the American engineers at McDonnell Douglas had dreamed it all up, the improvements had been such as to transform everything but the silhouette. Almost everything on Sato's personal bird was Japanese-made, even the engines, especially the electronics. There was a steady stream of aircraft in both directions, nearly all of them commercial wide-bodies, carrying businessmen to or from Japan, from or to North America, on a well-defined commercial routing that traced down the Kuril chain, past the Kamchatka Peninsula, then on to the Aleutians. If anyone wondered how important his country was, Sato thought in the privacy of his cockpit, this was it. The low-angle sun reflected off the aluminum tail fins of numerous aircraft, and from his current altitude of 37,000 feet, he could see them lined up like cars on a highway, it seemed, yellow dots preceding white trails of vapor that stretched off into infinity. Then it was time to go to work. The flight of four split into separated pairs left and right of the airliner track. The training mission for the evening was not complex, but vital nonetheless. Behind them, over 100 miles to the southwest, an airborne early warning aircraft was assuming its station just off the northeast tip of Honshu. That was an E-767, based on the twin-engine Boeing airliner, as the American E-3A was based on the far older 707 airframe. A rotating dome sat atop the converted wide body, just as his F-15J was an improved local version of an American fighter plane, so the E-767 was a vastly improved Japanese interpretation of another American invention. They'd never learn, Sato thought, his eyes scanning the horizon every few seconds before returning to the forward visual display. They'd invented so much, then given the unfulfilled rights to his countrymen for further perfection. In fact, the Americans had played the same game with the Russians, improving every military weapon the latter had ever made, but in their arrogance ignoring the possibility that someone could do the same with their own magical systems. The radar on the E-767 was like nothing aloft. For that reason, the radar on the nose of his Eagle was switched off. Simple in concept, the overall system was murderously complex in execution. The fighters had to know their precise position in three dimensions, and so did the AEW birds supporting them. Beyond that, radar pulses from the E-767 were precisely timed. The result was mere mathematics. Knowing the position of the transmitter and their own position, the Eagles could then receive the radar reflections and plot the blips as though the data were generated by their own onboard radar systems. A meld of Soviet-developed bistatic radars and American airborne radar technology, this system took the idea one step further. The AEW radar was frequency agile, able to switch instantly from a long-wave search mode to a short-wave fire control mode, and it could actually guide air-to-air missiles fired by the fighters. The radar was also of sufficient size and power that it could, everyone thought, defeat stealth technology. In only a few minutes, it was clear that the system worked. The four air-to-air missiles on his wings were dummies with no rocket motors. The seeker heads were real, however, and onboard instruments showed that the missiles were tracking inbound and outbound airliners even more clearly than they would have done from the Eagle's own radar. It was a first, a genuinely new piece of military technology. Only a few years earlier, Japan would probably have offered it for sale, almost certainly to America, because this sort of thing had value beyond gold. But the world had changed, and the Americans would probably have not seen the point in spending the money for it. Besides, Japan wasn't about to sell this to anyone. Not now, Sato thought. Especially not now. Their hotel was not necessarily an especially good one. Though it catered to foreign visitors, the management recognized that not all gaijin were wealthy. The rooms were small, the corridors narrow, the ceilings low, and a breakfast of a glass of juice, a cup of coffee, and one croissant cost only $50 instead of the 100 or so charged elsewhere. As the saying in the U.S. government went, Clark and Chavez were living off the economy, frugally, as Russians would have to do. It wasn't all that great a hardship. Crowded and intense as Japan was, it was still far more comfortable than Africa had been, and the food, while strange, was exotic and interesting enough that the novelty hadn't quite worn off yet. Ding might have grumped about the desire for a burger, but to say such a thing, even in Russian, would have broken cover. Returning after an eventful day, Clark inserted the keycard in the slot on the door and twisted the knob. He didn't even stop when he felt and removed the small piece of tape on the inside surface of the knob. Instead, he merely held it up to show Ding, then headed to the bathroom to flush it away. Chavez looked around the room, wondering if it was bugged, wondering if this spook stuff was all it was cracked up to be. It certainly seemed so mysterious. The tape on the doorknob. Somebody wanted to meet. Nomori. It had to be him. The field craft was clever, Chavez told himself. Whoever had left the marker had just walked down the corridor, and his hand had probably just tapped the knob, a gesture that even a careful observer might have missed. Well, that was the idea. "I'm going out for a drink," Clark announced in Russian. "I'll see what's up." "Vanya, you do too much of that." "Fine." It was his regular routine, in any case. "Some Russian you are," Clark said for the microphones, if any, as he went out the door. How the hell, Chavez wondered, am I supposed to get any studying done? He'd been forced to leave his books in Korea. They were all in English, of course. He couldn't take notes or go over things. If I have to lose time on my master's, Ding thought, I'm going to ask the agency to reimburse me for the blown courses. The bar, half a block away, was most agreeable. The room was dark, the booths were small and separated by solid partitions, and a mirror behind the ranks of liquor bottles made counter-surveillance easy. Better yet, the bar stools were almost all taken, which forced him to look elsewhere after a show of disappointment. Clark strolled all the way to the back. Nomori was waiting. "Taking chances, aren't we?" John said over the music. A waitress came up. He ordered a vodka neat, specifying a local one to save money. "Orders from home," Nomori told him. He stood without another word, clearly offended that a gaijin had taken the seat without asking permission first, and left without even a polite bow. Before the drink arrived, Clark reached under the table, finding a package taped in place there. In a moment it was in his lap and would soon find its way inside his waistband behind his back. Clark always bought his working clothes in a full cut. The Russian disguise helped even more, and his shoulders provided ample overhang for hiding things, yet another reason, he thought, to stay in shape. The drink arrived, and he took his time knocking it back, looking at the bar mirror and searching the reflections for faces that might have appeared in his memory before. It was a never-ending drill, and tiring as it was, one he learned the hard way not to ignore. He checked his watch twice, both times unobtrusively, then a third time immediately before standing, leaving behind just enough cash to pay for the drink. Russians weren't known as big tippers. The street was busy even in the late evening. Clark had established the routine nightcap over the past week, and on every other night he would roam the local shops. This evening he selected a bookstore first, one with long irregular rows. The Japanese were illiterate people. The shop always had people in it. He browsed around, selecting a copy of The Economist, then wandered more aimlessly toward the back, where he saw a few men eyeing the manga racks. Taller than they, he stood right behind a few, close but not too close, keeping his hands in front of him, shielded by his back. After 5 or so minutes, he made his way to the front and paid for the magazine, which the clerk politely bagged for him. The next stop was an electronics store where he looked at some CD players. This time he bumped into 2 people, each time politely asking their pardon, a phrase which he troubled himself to learn before anything else at Monterey. After that he headed back out onto the street and back to the hotel, wondering how much of the preceding 15 minutes had been a total waste of time. None of it, Clark told himself. Not a single second. In the room, he tossed Ding the magazine. It drew a look of its own before the younger man spoke. "Don't they have anything in Russian? It's good coverage of the difficulties between this country and America. Read and learn. Improve your language skills."
great. Just fucking great, Chavez thought, reading the words for their real meaning. We've been activated for real. He'd never finish the Masters now, Ding grumped. Maybe they just didn't want to jack his salary up as CIA regulations specified for a graduate degree. Had other things to do. The package Nomuri had transferred held a computer disk and a device that attached to a laptop. He switched it on, then inserted the disk into the slot. The file he opened contained only three sentences, and seconds after reading it, Clark had erased the disk. Next, he started composing what, to all intents and purposes, was a news dispatch. The computer was a Russian-language version of a popular Japanese model with all the additional Cyrillic letters, and the hard part for Clark was that although he read and spoke Russian like a native, he was used to typing, badly enough, in English. The Russian-style keyboard drove him crazy, and he sometimes wondered if someone would ever pick up on this small chink in his cover armor. It took over an hour to type up the news article, and another 30 to do the more important part. He saved both items to the hard drive, then turned the machine off. Flipping it over, he removed the modem from its modular port and replaced it with the new one Nomuri had brought. "What time is it in Moscow?" he asked tiredly. "Same as always, 6 hours behind us, remember?" "I'm going to send it to Washington, too." "Fine," Chekhov grunted. "I'm sure they'll love it, Ivan Sergeyevich." Clark attached the phone line to the back of his computer and used the latter to dial up the fiber-optic line to Moscow. Transferring the report took less than a minute. He repeated the operation for the Interfax office in the American capital. It was pretty slick, John thought. The moment before the modem at one end linked up with the modem at the other sounded just like static, which it was. The mating signal was just a rough hiss unless you had a special chip, and he never called anyone but Russian press agency offices. That the office in Washington might be tapped by the FBI was something else again. Finished, he kept one file and erased the other. Another day done serving his country. Clark brushed his teeth before collapsing into his single bed. "That was a fine speech, Godo-san." Yamato poured a generous amount of sake into an exquisite porcelain cup. "You made things so clear." "Did you see how they responded to me?" The little man was bubbling now, his enthusiasm making his body swell before his host's eyes. "And tomorrow you will have your cabinet, and the day after you will have a new office, Hiroshi." "You are certain?" A nod and a smile that conveyed true respect. "Of course I am. My colleagues and I have spoken with our friends, and they have come to agree with us that you are the only man suited to save our country." "When will it begin?" Goto asked, suddenly sobered by the words, remembering exactly what his ascension would mean. "When the people are with us." "Are you sure we can?" "Yes, I am sure." Yamato paused. "There is one problem, however."
"What is that?"
"Your lady friend Hiroshi. If the knowledge becomes public that you have an American mistress, it compromises you." "We cannot afford that," Yamato explained patiently. "I hope you will understand."
"Kimba is a most pleasant diversion for me," Goto objected politely.
"I have no doubt of it. But the Prime Minister can have his choice of diversions. And in any case, we will be busy in the next month."
The amusing part was that he could build up the man on one hand and reduce him on the other just as easily as he manipulated a child. And yet there was something disturbing about it all. More than one thing. How much had he told the girl, and what to do with her now?
"Poor thing, to send her home now, she will never know happiness again." "Undoubtedly true, but it must be done, my friend. Let me handle it for you. Better it should be done quietly, discreetly. You are on the television every day now. You cannot be seen to frequent that area as a private citizen would. There is too great a danger."
The man about to be prime minister looked down, sipping his drink, so transparently measuring his personal pleasure against his duties to his country, surprising Yamata yet again. But no, not really. Goto was Goto, and he'd been chosen for his elevation as much, more for his weaknesses than his strengths. "Aye," he said after reflection, "please see to it." "I know what to do," Yamata assured him. Chapter 15. A Damned Foolish Thing. Behind Ryan's desk was a gadget called a STU-6. The acronym probably meant Secure Telephone Unit, but he had never troubled himself to find out. It was about 2 feet square and contained in a nicely made oak cabinet, handcrafted by the inmates of a federal prison. Inside were a half-dozen green circuit boards populated with various chips, whose function was to scramble and unscramble telephone signals. Having one of these in the office was one of the better government status symbols. "Yeah," Jack said, reaching back for the receiver. "MP here. Something interesting came in." "Sandalwood," Mrs. Foldy said, her voice distinct on the digital line. "Flip on your fax." "Go ahead and send it." The STU-6 did that, too, fulfilling the function with a simple phone line that headed to Ryan's facsimile printer. "Did you get the word to them?" "Yes, we did." "Okay, wait a minute." Jack took the first page and started reading it. "This is Clark?" he asked. "Correct. That's why I'm fast-tracking it over to you. You know the guy as well as I do." "I saw the TV coverage. CNN says their crew got a little roughed up." Ryan worked his way down the first page. "Somebody bounced a soda can off the producer's head. Nothing more serious than a headache, but it's the first time anything like this has happened over there. That Ed and I remember, anyway." "God damn it," Ryan said next. "I thought you'd like that part. Thanks for the heads up, Mary Pat. Glad to help." The line went dead. Ryan took his time. His temper, he knew, was always his greatest enemy. He decided to give himself a moment to stand and head out of his office to the nearest water cooler, which was tucked in his secretary's office. Foggy Bottom, he'd heard, had once been a nice marsh before some fool had decided to drain it. What a pity the Sierra Club hadn't been around then to force an environmental impact statement. They were so good at obstructing things, and didn't much care whether the things they halted were useful or not, and as a result they occasionally did some public good. But not this time, Ryan told himself, sitting back down. Then he lifted the STU-6 and punched the speed dial button for state. "Good morning, Mr. Secretary," the National Security Advisor said pleasantly. "What's the story about the demonstration outside the Tokyo embassy yesterday?" "You saw CNN the same as I did, I'm sure," Hansen replied, as though it were not the function of an American embassy mission to provide better information than any citizen could get with his oatmeal. "Yes, I did, as a matter of fact, but I would really like to have the opinion of embassy personnel, like maybe the political officer, maybe even the DCM," Ryan said, allowing a little of his irritation to show. Ambassador Chuck Whiting was a recent political appointee, a former senator, who had then become a Washington lawyer and had actually represented some Japanese business interests. But the deputy chief of mission was an experienced man and a Japan specialist who knew the culture. "Walt decided to keep his people in. He didn't want to provoke anything. I'm not going to fault him for that." "That may be. But I have in my hand an eyewitness report from an experienced field officer who..." "I have it too, Ryan. It looks alarmist to me. Who is this guy?" "As I said, an experienced field officer." "Mm-hmm. I see he knows Iran." Ryan could hear the crackle of paper over the phone. "That makes him a spook. I guess that colored his thinking a little. How much experience in Japan?" "Not much, but there you are, alarmist, as I said. You want me to follow up on it, though?" "Yes, Mr. Secretary." "Okay, I'll call Walt. Anything else? I'm prepping for Moscow, too." "Please, let's light a fire under them." "Fine, Ryan. I'll make sure that gets through. Remember, it's already nighttime over there, okay?" "Fine." Ryan replaced the phone in its cradle and swore. Mustn't wake up the ambassador. He had several options. Typically, he took the most direct. He lifted his desk phone and punched the button for the president's personal secretary. I need to talk to the boss for a few. 30 minutes? That'll be fine, thank you. The delay was explained by a ceremony in the East Room that Ryan had had on his daily schedule sheet, too, but had forgotten about. It was just too big for the Oval Office, which suited the secretarial staff. 10 TV cameras and a good 100 or so journalists watched as Roger Durling affixed his signature to the Trade Reform Act. The nature of the legislation demanded a number of pens, one for each letter of his name, which made the signing a lengthy and haphazard process. The first went, naturally enough, to Al Trent, who'd authored the bill. The rest went to committee chairmen of the House and Senate, and also to selected minority members without whom the bill could not possibly have sailed through Congress as rapidly as it had. There was the usual applause, the usual handshakes, and a new entry was made in the United States Code annotated. The Trade Reform Act was now federal law. One of the TV crews was from NHK. Their faces were glum. Next, they would drive to the Commerce Department to interview the legal team that was analyzing Japanese laws and procedures for rapid duplication. It would be an unusually educational experience for the foreign journalists. Like most senior government officials, Chris Cook had a TV in his office. He watched the signing on C-SPAN, and with it saw the indefinite postponement of his entry into the private sector. It made him uneasy to accept outside payments while still a federal employee. They were going into a safe bank account, but it was illegal, wasn't it? He didn't really mean to break the law. Amity between America and Japan was important to him. It was now breaking down, and unless it could be rapidly restored, his career would stagnate and effectively end, despite all the promise it had shown for so many years. And he needed the money. He had a dinner with Seiji scheduled for tonight. They had to discuss ways of making things right again, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State told himself, returning to his work. On Massachusetts Avenue, Seiji Nagumo was watching the same TV channel and was just as unhappy. Nothing would ever be the same again, he thought. Perhaps the new government... No, Gatto was a demagogic fool. His posturing and blustering would only make things worse. The sort of action needed was... What? For the first time in his career, Nagumo had no idea what that might be. Diplomacy had failed. Lobbying had failed. Even espionage, if one could call it that, had failed. Espionage. Was that the proper term? Well, technically, yes, he admitted. He was now paying money for information. Cook and others... At least they were well placed. At least he'd been able to warn his government. At least the foreign ministry knew that he'd done his best, as much as any man could do. More, really. And he'd keep trying, working through Cook, to affect the way the Americans interpreted Japanese laws. But the Americans had a term for it, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Reflection only made it worse, and soon the only word for what he felt was anguish. His countrymen would suffer, America, the world, all because of one traffic accident that had killed 6 inconsequential people. It was madness. Madness or not, it was how the world worked. A messenger came into his office and handed over a sealed envelope for which Nagumo had to sign. He waited until his office door closed again before he opened it. The cover sheet told him much. The dispatch was eyes only. Even the ambassador would never learn of what he was now reading. The instructions on the next 2 pages made his hand shake. Nagumo remembered his history. Franz Ferdinand, June 28, 1914, in the cursed city of Sarajevo, a titled non-entity, a man of such little consequence that no one of importance had troubled himself to attend the funeral. But his murder had been the damned foolish thing to start the first war to span the globe. In this case, the inconsequential people had been a police officer and some females. And on such trivialities, this would happen? Nagumo went very pale, but he had no choice in the matter, because his life was driven by the same forces that turned the world on its axis. Exercise Dateline partners began at the scheduled time. Like most such war games, it was a combination of free play and strict rules. The size of the Pacific Ocean made for ample room, and the game would be played between Marcus Island, a Japanese possession, and Midway. The idea was to simulate a conflict between the U.S. Navy and a smaller but modern frigate force played by the Japanese Navy. The odds were heavily loaded against the latter, but not completely so. Marcus Island, called Minami Torishima on their charts, was, for the purpose of the exercise, deemed to be a continental landmass. In fact, the atoll consisted of a mere 740 acres, scarcely large enough for a meteorological station, a small fishing colony, and a single runway from which would fly a trio of P-3C patrol aircraft. These could be administratively shot down by American fighters, but would return to life the next day. The commercial fishermen, who also maintained a station on the island to harvest squid, kelp, and the occasional swordfish for their home markets, welcomed the increased activity. The airmen had brought a cargo of beer, which they would exchange for the fresh catch in what had become a friendly tradition. Two of the three Orions lifted off before dawn, angling north and south to search for the American carrier fleet. Their crewmen, aware of the trade problems between the two countries, concentrated on their mission. It was not an unknown mission to the Japanese Navy, after all. Their forefathers had done the same thing two generations before in Kawasaki H-8K2 flying boats, the same contractor that had built these Orions, to search for the marauding carriers commanded in turns by Halsey and Spruance. Many of the tactics they would employ today were based on lessons learned from that earlier conflict. The P-3Cs themselves were Japanese models of an American design that had begun life as turboprop airliners, then matured into rugged, powerful, if somewhat slow, maritime patrol aircraft. As with most Japanese military aircraft, the American products had stopped at the basic profile. The power plants had since been developed and improved, giving the Orions a cruising speed boosted to 350 knots. The internal electronics were particularly good, especially the sensors designed to detect emissions from ships and aircraft. That was their mission for the moment, to fly out in large pie-shaped segments, listening for radar and radio signals that would announce the presence of American ships and aircraft. Reconnaissance. Find the enemy. That was the mission. And from press accounts and conversations with family members who worked in their country's economy, thinking of Americans as the enemy didn't even come all that hard. Aboard John Stennis, Captain Sanchez watched the Dawn Patrol, a term beloved of all fighter pilots, shoot off the cats to establish an outer combat air patrol. With the Tomcats off, next in line to go were the S-3 Vikings, anti-submarine birds with long legs to sweep the area the fleet would transit this day. Last went the Prowlers, the electronic bird dogs designed to detect and jam enemy radar signals. It was always exciting to watch from his perch at Pryfly. Almost as good as shooting off himself, but he was the CAG and was supposed to command rather than merely lead his men now. His Alpha Strike Force of Hornets was spotted on the deck, loaded with blue practice missiles for the discovery of the enemy battle force. The pilots, sitting in their squadron ready rooms, mainly reading magazines or trading jokes, because they were already briefed in on the mission. Admiral Sato watched his flagship disengage from the oiler Hamana, one of four supporting his fleet. The captain of the fleet support ship lofted his cap and waved encouragement. Sato returned the gesture as the oiler put her rudder over to depart the battle force. He now had enough fuel to drive his ships hard. The contest was an interesting one, essentially guile against brute force, not an unusual situation for his country's navy, and for this task he would employ traditional Japanese tactics. His 16 surface warships were split into three groups, one of eight and two of four, widely separated. Similar to Yamamoto's plan for the Battle of Midway, his operational concept was far more practical now, because with GPS navigation their position was always known, and with satellite communications links they could exchange messages in relative security. The Americans probably expected that he would keep his ships close to his homeland, but he would not. He would take the issue to the enemy as best he could, since passive defense was not the way of his people, a fact that the Americans had learned and then forgotten, hadn't they? That was an amusing thought.
Yes, Jack.
The president was in another good mood, flush from signing a new law which he hoped would solve a major problem for his country, and, by the by, make his re-election chances look rosy indeed. It would be a shame to ruin his day, Ryan thought, but his job wasn't political, at least not that kind of political.
You might want to look at this. He handed the fact sheet over without sitting down.
Our friend Clark again, Durling asked, leaning back in his chair and reaching for his reading glasses. He had to read them for normal correspondence, though his speeches and teleprompters had large enough type to protect his presidential vanity.
I presume State is seeing this. What do they say? The president asked when he finished it.
Hansen calls it alarmist, Jack reported, but the ambassador kept his troops inside for the event because he didn't want to cause an incident. This is the only eyewitness report we have, aside from the TV people.
I haven't read the text of his speech yet. I have it here somewhere.
Durling gestured at his desk. Might be a good idea to do so. I just did. The president nodded.
And what else? I know there's more.
And I told Mary Pat to activate Thistle. He explained briefly what that was.
You really should get my permission first.
That's what I'm here for, sir. You know a little about Clark. He doesn't scare easily. Thistle includes a couple of people in their foreign ministry and MITI. I think we want to know what they're thinking.
They're not enemies, Durling observed.
Probably not, Jack conceded for the first time, allowing for the fact that the proper response wasn't certainly not, a fact the president noted with a raised eyebrow.
We still need to know, sir. That's my recommendation.
Okay, approved. What else? I also told her to get Kimberly Norton out soonest. It ought to happen in the next 24 hours.
Sending Goto a message, are we?
That's part of it. Simpler version is, we know she's there, and she's an American citizen, and
I have kids, too. Also approved. Save the piety for church, Jack.
Durling ordered with a smile.
How will it go?
If she agrees to come out, they drive her to the airport and fly her to Seoul. They have clothes for her and a fresh passport and first-class tickets for her and an escort she'll meet at the terminal. She changes planes to a KAL flight to New York. We check her into a hotel, settle her down, and debrief. We fly her parents in from Seattle and explain to them that it's to be kept quiet.
The girl will probably need psychological counseling. I mean, really need it.
That will help with the low profile. The FBI will assist on that when her father's a cop. He should play along. And that was neat and tidy enough for anyone, wasn't it? The president gave Ryan a nod.
So then, what do we tell Goto about it?
That's your decision, Mr. President. I would recommend nothing at the moment. Let's debrief the girl first, say a week or so, and then the ambassador will check in for the usual courtesy visit to present your greetings to a new head of government,
and ask him politely how his countrymen will react if Mr. Nationalist turned out to be dipping his wick in a round eye.
Then we extend a small olive branch, right? Durling caught on quickly enough, Jack thought. That's my recommendation, sir.
A very small one, the president noted dryly.
Just an olive on it for the moment, Ryan conceded.
Approved, Durling said again, adding more sharply. Next, are you going to suggest what olive branch to offer?
No, sir. Have I pushed too much? Jack asked, realizing just how far he had gone. Durling almost apologized for speaking crossly to his national security adviser.
You know, Bob was right about you.
Excuse me?
Bob Fowler, Durling said, waving Ryan into a chair. You ticked me off pretty bad when I brought you in the first time.
Sir, I was a burnout then, remember?
Jack did.
The nightmares hadn't stopped yet. He saw himself sitting there in the National Military Command Center telling people what they had to do. But in the nightmare, they couldn't see or hear him, as the hotline message kept coming in, taking his country closer and closer to the war he had in fact probably stopped. The full story on that had never been written in the open media, just as well. Everyone who had been there knew. I didn't understand that then. Anyway, Durling raised his arms to stretch. When we dropped the ball last summer, Bob and I talked some things over up at Camp David. He recommended you for the job. Surprised, the president asked with a twisty grin. Very, Jack admitted quietly. Arnie Van Damme had never told him that story. Ryan wondered why. He said, "You're one level-headed son of a bitch when the crap hits the fan." He also said, "You were an opinionated, pushy son of a bitch the rest of the time." Good judge of character, Bob Fowler. Durling gave him a moment to absorb that. "You're a good man in a storm, Jack. Do us both a favor, and remember that this is as far as you can act without my approval. You've already had another pissing contest with Brett, haven't you?" "Yes, sir." Jack bobbed his head like a schoolboy. "Just a little one. Don't push so hard. He's my Secretary of State." "I understand, sir." "All ready for Moscow?" "Kathy's really looking forward to it," Ryan answered, pleased with the change of subject and noting that Durling had handled him very well indeed. "It'll be good to see her again, and really likes her. Anything else?" "Not right now." "Jack, thanks for the heads up," Durling said to conclude the meeting on a positive note. Ryan left the office by the west door, walking past the Teddy Roosevelt room and heading toward his office. Ed Keelty was in again, he saw, working in his office. He wondered when that one would break, realizing that the president, however pleased with the events of this day, still had that scandal hanging over him. That sword again, Jack thought. He had gone a little closer to the edge this time, and it was his mission to make the president's job easier, not harder. There was more to it, after all, than foreign entanglements, and politics, something he'd tried to keep at arm's length for years, was as real as anything else. Fowler? Damn. It would be a safe time to do it, they knew. Goto was giving a speech on TV tonight, his maiden broadcast as prime minister, and whatever he said, it guaranteed that he wouldn't be with his young mistress that evening. Perhaps the night's mission would be an interesting and useful counterpoint to what the politician had to say, a reply of sorts from America. They both liked that idea. John Clark and Ding Chavez were walking along the block at the proper time, looking across the crowded street at the nondescript building. They always seemed that way, John thought. Maybe someone would tumble to the idea that a garish facade or an office tower was actually better camouflage. Or maybe not. More likely it was boredom talking again. A man came out and removed his sunglasses with his left hand. He smoothed his hair, stroking the back of his head twice with his left hand, then moved off. Nomuri had never ascertained the location of Kim Norton's room. Moving in that close was a risk, but the orders had come to take that risk. And now, having given the signal, he walked off toward where he'd left his car. 10 seconds later, Nomuri was lost in the crowded sidewalk. Clark saw. He could do that. He had the right height and looks. So did Ding. With his size, glossy black hair, and complexion, Chavez at a distance could almost blend in here. The haircut he'd imposed on his partner helped even more. From behind, he was just another person on the sidewalk. That was useful, Clark told himself, feeling ever more conspicuous, especially at a moment like this. Showtime, Ding breathed. Both men crossed the street as unobtrusively as possible. Clark was dressed as a businessman, but rarely had he felt more naked. Neither he nor Ding had so much as a folding pocket knife. Though both men were skilled in unarmed combat, both had enough experience to prefer arms, the better to keep one's enemies at a distance. Luck smiled on them. There was no one in the tiny lobby of the building to note their presence. The two men took the stairs up, second floor, all the way back, left side. Nomuri had done his job well. The corridor was empty. Clark had the lead and headed quickly down the dimly lit passage. The lock was a simple one. With Ding standing guard, he took out his burglar tools and defeated it, then opened the door quickly. They were already inside before they realized that the mission was a bust. Kimberly Norton was dead. She lay on a futon, wearing a medium expensive silk kimono that was bunched just below the knees, exposing her lower legs. Post-mortem lividity was beginning to color the underside of her body as gravity drew her blood downward. Soon the top of the body would be the color of ash, and the lower regions would be maroon. Death was so cruel, John thought. It wasn't enough that it stole life. It also stole whatever beauty the victim had once possessed. She'd been pretty. Well, that was the point, wasn't it? John checked the body against the photograph, a passing resemblance to his younger daughter, Patsy. He handed the picture to Ding. He wondered if the lad would make the same connection.
It's her.
Concur, John, Chavez observed huskily. It's her.
Pause.
Shit, he concluded quietly, examining the face for a long moment that made his face twist with anger.
So, Clark thought, he sees it too.
Got a camera?
Yeah. Ding pulled out a compact 35mm out of his pants pocket.
Play cop?
That's right.
Clark stooped down to examine the body. It was frustrating. He wasn't a pathologist, and though he had much knowledge of death, more knowledge still was needed to do this right. There, in the vein on the top of her foot, a single indentation, not much more than that. So, she'd been on drugs? If so, she'd been a careful user, John thought. She'd always cleaned the needle, and he looked around the room. There, a bottle of alcohol and a plastic bag of cotton swabs and a bag of plastic syringes.
I don't see any other needle marks. They don't always show, man, Chavez observed.
Clark sighed and untied the kimono, opening it. She'd been wearing nothing under it.
Fuck,
Chavez rasped. There was fluid inside her thighs.
That's a singularly unsuitable thing to say, Clark whispered back.
It was as close as he'd come to losing his temper in many years.
Take your pictures.
Ding didn't answer. The camera flashed and whirred away. He recorded the scene as a forensic photographer might have done. Clark then started to rearrange the kimono, uselessly giving the girl back whatever dignity that death and man had failed to rob from her.
Wait a minute. Left hand.
Clark examined it. One nail was broken. All the others were medium long, evenly coated with a neutral polish. He examined the others. There was something under them.
Scratch somebody? Clark asked.
See any place she scratched herself, Mr. C? Ding asked.
No.
Then she wasn't alone when it happened, man. Check her ankles again, Chavez said urgently. On the left one, the foot with the puncture, the underside of the ankle revealed bruises almost concealed by the building lividity. Chavez shot his last frame.
I thought so.
Tell me why later. We're out of here, John said, standing.
Within less than a minute, they were out the back door, down the meandering alley, and back on a main thoroughfare to wait for their car. That was close, Chavez observed, as the police car pulled up to number 18. There was a TV crew 15 seconds behind.
Don't you just love it? They're going to tie up everything real nice and neat.
What is it, Ding?
Ain't right, Mr. C. Supposed to look like an OD, right?
Yeah, why?
Yo, Dion Smack, man, it just stops. Boom. Bye-bye. I seen a guy go out like that back in the old days. Never got the sticker out of his arm, okay? Heart stops. Lungs stop. Gone. You don't get up and set the needle down and then lay back down, okay? Bruises on the leg. Somebody struck her. She was murdered, John. And probably she was raped, too.
I saw the paraphernalia. All U.S. made. Nice setup. They close the case, blame the girl and her family, give their own people an object lesson.
Clark looked over as the car pulled around the corner.
Good eye, Ding.
Thanks, boss.
Chavez fell silent again, his anger building now that he had nothing to do but think it over.
You know, I'd really like to meet that guy.
We won't.
Time for a little perverse fantasy.
I know, but I used to be a ninja, remember? It might be real fun, especially barehanded.
That just breaks bones. Pretty often your own bones.
I'd like to see his eyes when it happens.
So put a good scope on the rifle, Clark advised.
True, Chavez conceded. What kind of a person gets off on that, Mr. C?
One sick motherfucker, Domingo. I met a few once.
Just before they got into the car, Ding's black eyes locked on Clark.
Maybe I will meet this one personally, John. El Fado can play tricks. Funny ones.
Where is she? Nomori asked from behind the wheel.
Drive, Clark told him.
You should have heard the speech, Chet said, moving up the street and wondering what had gone wrong.
The girl's dead, Ryan told the president barely 2 hours later, 1 p.m. Washington time.
Natural causes, Durling asked.
Drug overdose, probably not self-administered. They have photos. We ought to have them in 36 hours. Our guys just got clear in time. The Japanese police showed up pretty fast.
Wait a minute. Back up. You're saying murder?
That's what our people think, yes, Mr. President.
Do they know enough to make that evaluation?
Ryan took his seat and decided that he had to explain a little bit.
Sir, our senior officer knows a few things about the subject, yes.
That was nicely phrased, the president noted dryly.
I don't want to know any more about that subject, do I?
No reason for it right now, sir, no.
Koto?
Possibly one of his people. Actually, the best indicator will be how their police report it. If anything they tell us is at variance with what we've learned from our own people, then we'll know that somebody played with the data, and not all that many people have the ability to order changes in police reports.
Jack paused for a moment.
Sir, I've had another independent evaluation of the man's character. He went on to report Chris Hunter's story.
You're telling me that you believe he had this young girl killed and will use his police to cover it up? And you already knew he likes that sort of thing.
Durling flushed.
You wanted me to extend this bastard an olive branch? What the hell's the matter with you?
Jack took a deep breath.
Okay, Mr. President, I had that coming. The question is, now what do we do?
Durling's face changed.
You didn't deserve that. Sorry.
Actually, I do deserve it, Mr. President. I could have told Mary Pat to get her out some time ago.
But I didn't, Ryan observed bleakly.
I didn't see this one coming.
We never do, Jack. Now what?
We can't tell the legal attaché at the embassy because we don't know about this yet. But I think we prep the FBI to check things out after we're officially notified. I can call Dan Murray about that.
Shaw's designated hitter?
Ryan nodded. Dan and I go back a ways. For the political side, I'm not sure. The transcript of his TV speech just came in. Before you read it, well, you need to know what sort of fellow we're dealing with.
Tell me, how many common bastards like that run countries?
You know better than I do, sir. Jack thought about that for a moment.
It's not entirely a bad thing. People like that are weak, Mr. President. Cowards when you get down to it. If you have to have enemies, better that they have weaknesses.
He might make a state visit, Durling thought. We might have to put him up at Blair House right across the street, throw a state dinner. We'll walk out into the East Room and make pretty speeches and toast each other and shake hands as though we're bosom buddies.
Be damned to that.
He lifted the folder with Goto's speech and skimmed through it.
That son of a bitch. America will have to understand my ass.
Anger, Mr. President, isn't an effective way of dealing with problems.
You're right, Durling admitted.
He was silent for a moment, then he smiled in a crooked way.
You're the one with a hot temper, as I recall.
Ryan nodded. I've been accused of that, yes, sir.
Well, that's two big ones we have to deal with when we get back from Moscow.
Three, Mr. President. We need to decide what to do about India and Sri Lanka.
Jack could see from the look on Durling's face that the president had allowed himself to forget about that one.
Durling had allowed himself to semi-forget another problem as well.
How much longer will I have to wait? Ms. Linders demanded.
Murray could see her pain even more clearly than he heard it.
How did you explain this to people? Already the victim of a vile crime, she'd gotten out in the open, bearing her soul for all manners of strangers. The process hadn't been fun for anyone, but least of all for her. Murray was a skilled and experienced investigator. He knew how to console, encourage, chivy information out of people. He'd been the first FBI agent to listen to her story, in the process becoming as much a part of her mental health team as Dr. Golden. After that had come another pair of agents, a man and a woman who specialized more closely in cases of this type. After them had come two separate psychiatrists, whose questioning had necessarily been somewhat adversarial, both to establish finally that her story was true in all details, and to give her a taste of the hostility she would encounter. Along the way, Murray realized Barbara Linders had become even more of a victim than she'd been before. She'd built herself up, first to reveal herself to Clarice, then again to do the same with Murray, then again and yet once more still. Now she looked forward to the worst ordeal of all, for some of the members of the Judiciary Committee were allies of Ed Keelty, and some would take it upon themselves to hammer the witness hard, either to curry favor with the cameras or to demonstrate their impartiality and professionalism as lawyers. Barbara knew that. Murray had himself walked her through the expected ordeal, even hitting her with the most awful of questions, always preceded with as gentle a preamble as possible, like, "One of the things you can expect to be asked is..." It took its toll, and a heavy toll at that. Barbara, they were too close now for him to think of her as Miss Linders, had shown all the courage one could expect of a crime victim, and more besides. But courage was not something one picked out of the air. It was something like a bank account. You could withdraw only so much before it was necessary to stop, to take the time to make new deposits. Just the waiting, the not knowing when she would have to take her seat in the committee room and make her opening statement in front of bright TV lights, the certainty that she would have to bare her soul for the entire world. It was like a robber coming into the bank night after night to steal from her hard-won accumulation of inner resolve. It was hard enough for Murray. He'd built his case, had the prosecutor lined up, but he was the one close to her. It was his mission, Murray told himself, to show this lady that men were not like Ed Keelty, that a man was as repulsed by such acts as women were. He was her knight errant. The disgrace and ultimate imprisonment of that criminal was now his mission in life even more than it was hers. "Barb, you have to hang in there, kid. We're going to get this bastard, but we can't do it the right way unless..." He mouthed the words, putting conviction he didn't feel into them. Since when did politics enter into a criminal case? The law had been violated. They had their witnesses, their physical evidence, but now they were stuck in a holding pattern that was as damaging to this victim as any defense lawyer might be. "It's taking too long. 2 more weeks, maybe 3, and we go to bat, Barb. Look, I know something is happening, okay? You think I'm dumb? He's not out making speeches and opening bridges and stuff now, is he? Somebody told him, and he's building up his case, isn't he?" "I think what's happening is that the president is deliberately holding him in close so that when this does break, he won't be able to fall back on a high public profile as a defense. The president is on our side, Barb. I've briefed him on this case myself, and he said a criminal is a criminal, and that's exactly what he should have said." Her eyes came up to meet his. They were moist and desperate. "I'm coming apart, Dan." "No, Barb, you're not," Murray lied. "You're one tough, smart, brave lady. You're going to come through this. He's the one who's going to come apart." Daniel E. Murray, Deputy Assistant Director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, reached his hand across the table. Barbara Linders took it, squeezing it as a child might with her father, forcing herself to believe and to trust. And it shamed him that she was paying such a price because the President of the United States had to subordinate a criminal case to a question of politics. Perhaps it made sense in the great scheme of things, but for a cop, the great scheme of things usually came down to one crime and one victim. Chapter 16. Payloads. The final step in arming the H-11 SS-19 missiles necessarily had to await official word from the nation's prime minister. In some ways, the final payoff was something of a disappointment. They had originally hoped to affix a full complement of warheads, at least 6 each, to the nose of each bird, but to do that